This video is sponsored by Squarespace. More about them in just a moment.
Many of us have heard of the big name books in philosophy, things like Plato's Republic or Nietzsche's Beyond Good and Evil. And these, understandably, crop up in YouTube book recommendations an awful lot, as they should. They are immensely influential texts. But today, I don't want to talk about any of those. I want to take some of the most famous thinkers in history and look at their underappreciated gems. I also want to introduce some philosophers that I think are just as brilliant, but go tragically undernoticed. If this sounds like I'm about to be an insufferable hipster about philosophy, that's because I probably am. I've tried to cut the right balance where each of these are broad enough to be appealing, but obscure enough that I hope that most of them will be new to at least some of you. Above all, each of them are, in my opinion, deeply underrated. But let's start with a less famous text by an incredibly famous name. Friedrich Nietzsche's Schopenhauer as Educator. For an essay ostensibly written by one big-name philosopher about another big-name philosopher, I'm surprised at just how overlooked this work is in particular in popular discussions around Nietzsche. Sure, it's not as bombastic as some of his more famous works, but if anything, this is to its credit, and actually rather refreshing. This is a different side to Nietzsche, where he provides important context as to what the aim of his overall philosophical project is going to be. I obviously can't cover the full details of the work here, so consider this more of a pitch than a summary. If you want to read it by the end of this section, then I have done my job. The first thing that really leaps out at me is that this essay puts in perspective some of Nietzsche's more negative ideas about mankind. I often see people quote choice passages from Thus Spake Zarathustra and Beyond Good and Evil as if Nietzsche is a straightforwardly hateful figure, because he does quite often heap scorn upon what he calls the herd. But in Schopenhauer as Educator, we really see that this comes from a belief in people's quite powerful individual potential. To quote the first pages of his essay, "There exists no more repulsive creature in the world than the man who has evaded his genius and who now is wholly exterior." Here, Nietzsche only despairs of the majority of people because he thinks they refuse to think for themselves and merely parrot the ideas and values they've inherited from others. He also gives a pretty harsh critique of the general trend of academic philosophy. In his opinion, it has become far too concerned with abstract matters and has lost sight with what the true aim of a philosopher and an educator ought to be, which Nietzsche thinks is to teach people how to live. Thus, he uses Schopenhauer as his model, although his portrait of Schopenhauer here is more of an idealized version that Nietzsche wished to learn from. For Nietzsche, Schopenhauer represents someone who deliberately dissented from the largely academic concerns of the German university and aimed to understand life as a whole from the perspective of someone living it. He especially admires Schopenhauer because he thinks that he was able to break free from a culture that does everything it can to promote conformity and suppress the sort of intellectual project that Schopenhauer was specifically interested in. Nietzsche is highly concerned that his society is stifling anyone trying to become who they are. With all of this context, we can better understand what Nietzsche is going for in his later works. When he talks about someone who legislates values, as in the case of his new philosophers or the philosophers of the future, we can now get a better grasp of the kind of thing he might have in mind. This sort of philosophy is not merely an abstract project. He does not want people to just write great tracts about what they think we ought to value. He wants examples and prototypes that can teach people by their actions and their lives how someone can become themselves. It also gives one reason why the people he praises in his work are so very varied. Why, for example, does he praise Plato as a genius while condemning his ideas? And why does he talk about Napoleon and Goethe in immensely positive terms when one is a great conqueror and the other is a revolutionary author? It makes a bit more sense if we think of these people not just in terms of what they did or what they wrote or what they thought, but in what they and their lives represented. For Nietzsche, these are free spirits, people who did not just replicate or refine the way of life that was handed down to them, but embarked on a new path. It's also now much clearer why he praised Christ but despaired of Christianity. He saw the value in Jesus as in how he lived, not necessarily in the lessons he explicitly taught, and especially not in the metaphysics that eventually came along with this. It explains why he thought Kant was a great thinker, but not a philosopher in his terms, because he was not a real human being, since Nietzsche thought Kant devoted himself too much to abstract concerns and not enough to the question of life. Obviously, there are highly differing interpretations here, but that's certainly how it contributed to my personal understanding of Nietzsche. But perhaps the strangest thing about this essay is how little Nietzsche discusses Schopenhauer's actual philosophy in detail. He doesn't give an in-depth analysis of the world as will and representation, or really talk that much about particular specificities of Schopenhauer's thought. Instead, he dwells on its general character and its relevance to the way we live. Considering that Schopenhauer's name is literally in the title of this essay, this can at first seem quite odd. It's a bit like those video essays you occasionally come across which spend 3 hours discussing a TV show while barely talking about what actually happens in them. But this, again, gives us a hint as to how Nietzsche may want to stand in relation to us. One of the strangest and most difficult to pass passages in Nietzsche's philosophy comes at the end of Ecce Homo. I won't recap it here since I've talked about it at quite a bit of length elsewhere, but essentially, Nietzsche makes it clear that he does not want the kind of reader who would slavishly follow his recommendations, but instead, one who would build their own independent philosophy and become who they are rather than who Nietzsche is. On the face of it, this seems a little bit strange, because Nietzsche has, after all, spent the last 8 or so books specifically giving us his philosophy. What was the point of all that if, at the last moment, he's going to say, actually, think for yourself and don't follow me? Well, I think we can consider how Nietzsche relates to his own philosophical educator, Schopenhauer. On the one hand, Nietzsche greatly admires him, and Schopenhauer's pessimism is a key theme in Nietzsche's earlier works and clearly influenced his later ones. However, by his more mature volumes, Nietzsche does explicitly reject the Schopenhauerian worldview in incredibly vitriolic terms, saying that it will lead to a gradual erasure of everything that he admires about mankind. Nonetheless, Schopenhauer was a major starting point for Nietzsche's own philosophy. By critiquing it, dissecting it, learning from it, and eventually rejecting it, Nietzsche came to form his own views. His philosophy is inextricably linked to Schopenhauer's in sort of the same way that Romanticism is linked to the Enlightenment. It is both a development of some of its key themes and builds on some of its discoveries, but at the same time, it is a reaction to it, and spends just as much, if not more, time in critique of Enlightenment thinking as it does in praise of it. Though this is just speculative, I could not help but think, when reading this essay, that perhaps this is part of how Nietzsche wanted people to engage with his philosophy as well. For it to be something that we wrestle with intensely as we develop our own philosophy. So yes, I think this definitely falls into the category of underappreciated gem. But before moving on, I want to take a quick moment to thank our very kind sponsors, Squarespace. If you're looking to build a website, then you'll know it can be a real hassle. First, you have to find a domain name and then construct the entire thing, and there's always this underlying fear that you're messing up and creating something that doesn't just look messy, but actually seems unprofessional. But this is where Squarespace comes into play. They compress all of that complexity and headache into a single platform and use ready-made templates to take most of the complication and pain out of website building. They also have a feature called Blueprint AI, which uses AI tools to help you make design choices, which is really handy if, like me, you're not necessarily that technologically gifted and don't have the mind of a graphic designer. Head to squarespace.com/unsolicitedadvice and use the code unsolicitedadvice to get 10% off your first purchase of a domain name or a website. But anyway, back to the video. Søren Kierkegaard, The Present Age. This is probably the most famous work on this list, and is also by a huge name. Kierkegaard stands astride existential philosophy like a colossus, and almost every single thinker that came after him had to contend in some way with his ideas. Okay, so the best way I think we can get inside the head of Kierkegaard writing this essay is to use a modern example in a completely different context about something totally unrelated. You know how in a Marvel film or anything written by Joss Whedon, There'll be an emotional moment. The music will swell, the characters will tear up, and you'll be on the edge of your seat, waiting to receive that final, pathos-filled blow, only for the violins to abruptly stop as one of the characters looks the camera dead in the eye and says something to the effect of, "Wow, this is like some kind of movie," at which point you feel like such a fool for ever bothering to care. The narrative now seems devoid of passion, too embarrassed to commit to any emotion at all. It appears aloof, and almost like it's looking down on you. The first time this happens, it can be quite fun. Your expectations are subverted, and you have a good chuckle. The second time, it might retain a glimmer of that initial charm. But by the 20th, you are chewing your cinema seat and begging someone, anyone, to take the emotions in their film seriously. In the mid-19th century, Kierkegaard is in a relatively similar frame of mind, but about the general approach to information. The Present Age is a chapter from a larger work that is ostensibly a book review, but in the end is just so much more. Kierkegaard's critique of his age is centered around passion, and specifically, passion for ideas. Obviously, I can't go into the whole line of argument here, but to give a brief sketch, Kierkegaard thinks there is too much information out there, and that our attitude towards that information has thereby unpleasantly changed. With the rise of a particular journalistic culture in Denmark, Kierkegaard thinks the citizens of his community now look at information in a detached and dispassionate manner. That is, they may take the information in, but this doesn't translate into decisive action or an existential direction for their lives. Perhaps the most famous interpretation of this work is from Hubert Dreyfus, and in some ways, his research on the present age is as insightful as the original work itself. Kierkegaard outlines two things that tend to happen when we have access to too much information that is coming at us far too quickly. We may become eternal commentators. That is, our engagement with these ideas will remain at the level of chatter. We will look at information not so much as telling us about the world or as imparting potential wisdom, but as providing us with something clever to say the next time we want to impress someone. Though Kierkegaard obviously doesn't use this term, I think that a reasonably decent modern phrase to encapsulate this general feel is irony poisoning. The Kierkegaardian chatterer is not taking the information that they receive at all seriously. They are treating it purely for its entertainment value or its outward qualities. They cannot examine the ideas for truth because there are just too many to sort through. So they content themselves with looking at aesthetics instead. The other figure that Kierkegaard and Dreyfus touch upon is someone paralyzed by the sheer amount of important information out there. They are different from the previous character because they truly do wish to take the ideas that they encounter seriously, but they are just as susceptible to this information overload. As a result, they exhaust themselves by piling on so many important issues onto their backs that they never end up doing much good for any of them. They desperately desire to reform the nation and the church and publish great ideas and make their mark on the global stage. Thus, they end up just as unfruitful as the person who never took any idea seriously at all. Dreyfus connects this to two of Kierkegaard's three stages of life, the aesthetic stage and the ethical stage, but we don't need to go into that here. I just want us to sit back and realize how absurdly relevant this is for the internet age. If Kierkegaard thought there was too little passion in how people engage with information and too much information for any person to sift through in 1846, what on earth would he think today? While exact estimates vary, there seems to be a general consensus that the majority of information ever, estimated in bytes, has been generated in the past 20 years, and some people even say in the past two. We can get more information on more disparate topics from more divergent sources in one afternoon than a 19th century Danishman could get in a week. In hindsight, Kierkegaard's reaction to his own time almost seems like overkill, but it's incredibly relevant to our own. I also think this is an excellent Kierkegaardian work for anyone who might be put off by how explicitly theological Kierkegaard's other writings often are. I personally really enjoy those, but if you want an explicit example of how these ideas that originated to do with God, religion, and faith are still applicable to a wide variety of non-religious topics, then the present age is absolutely up your alley. But anyway, moving on. John Stuart's A History of Nihilism in the 19th Century. I can almost guarantee that very few people will have read this one. It only came out in 2023 and is definitely aimed at a more academic audience. But it has also fundamentally shaped the way that I approach the topic of nihilism and also does not require pretty much any prior knowledge to be both understandable and valuable. Here, Stuart surveys a whole series of literary figures, philosophers, and poets to uncover what characterized nihilism in 19th century Europe. I know that sounds a bit dry, but his actual thesis is incredibly interesting. Stuart concludes that the defining property of nihilism in this period is something like broken promises. He talks about nihilism as a reaction to the Enlightenment calling into question some of humanity's most existentially comforting beliefs that people had just taken for granted. The most famous of these is a belief in God, and Stuart does talk about that. But the more interesting parts of his book deal with the other existentially foundational claims that 19th century science and philosophy called into question. For instance, Stuart has an extended discussion on the theory of evolution by natural selection. He claims that this fundamentally destabilized the privileged position of the human as compared with the rest of the animal kingdom. It suggested that we may not be defined by our rationality or our agency, but are just as subject to arbitrary natural instincts as other creatures. How many of our behaviors have no deeper or more profound motive than a dog humping its owner's leg or a cat exercising its hunting instincts by killing mice even when it has no need to? Stuart charts the philosophical impact of such ideas, as well as hinting at their later developments with the modern field of psychoanalysis. One reason I enjoy Stuart's perspective is because he doesn't label one particular belief as the core of post-Enlightenment nihilism, but recognizes that it emerges from a succession of broken promises that just gradually disenchanted the pre-existing view of the world, at least in the eyes of some people. This is a wonderful antidote to more simplistic accounts of nihilism, which simply lay the blame at the feet of atheism or materialism and then wash their hands and are done with it. The broken promises model gives us a framework to analyze not only newer forms of societal nihilism, but also existential crises at an individual level, which I think is just much more helpful. For example, in the UK, a rise in helplessness and nihilism among young people almost certainly has as much to do with rising house prices and the unaffordability of a family as anything else. At first, this might seem mysterious, as these things are not closely connected with the concept of meaning. However, it is a broken promise about a life narrative. The dominant narrative for a human life in the UK since the end of the Second World War has been to eventually own a house, start a family, and retire at the end of your life. This narrative was not trivial. It was the received idea of how a human existence was meant to go. If someone is raised Catholic and then loses their faith, of course this is existentially depressing. It is a broken promise about eternity, and what could be more important than that? Both classic and new forms of nihilism or hopelessness can be given a unified treatment. This really made me sit back and question what narratives I had been fed about much of my life. For example, how many of us have been exposed to a very particular idea of what love is like? That it is always unfailingly selfless, that our lover will bring us endless happiness, and that this will all happen without very much effort on our part. Of course, this is not true. Relationships do not turn life into a blissful paradise, and you will still have a lot of the problems you had before you entered the relationship. This is not the fault of the lover, it's just that no one has the power of a god, and no person can tap dance into your life, solve all your problems, and then whisk you away to the promised land. But then, this got me thinking about the classic cycle so many of my friends had gone through in their romantic pairings. They would be with someone, convinced that they are the one for the rest of their life. Then, when those initial highs inevitably faded a little bit, and they found that they were still dissatisfied with much of their lives, they would blame their lover and abandon their relationship. After this would come a stage of romantic nihilism, for want of a better word, where they lost confidence in love to do any good at all. But finally, their belief in the classic myths of love would return, and they would venture back out into the world of romance, without ever considering that perhaps there might have been something wrong with the initial narrative that they had just inherited. I talked about this very cycle in my video on modern love, and I've since used this Broken Promises model to analyze all sorts of areas where I've noticed a general malaise amongst the people that I know. The fact that Stuart surveys so many different thinkers, from Shelley to Schopenhauer to Nietzsche to Turgenev, is also incredibly handy for anyone who wants to think about nihilism or existential philosophy more generally. As with a lot of things, getting a variety of perspectives on an issue can awaken us to gaps in our own viewpoint. Although there are certainly things that I do disagree with in this book. For example, I think Stuart's treatment of Nietzsche is a little bit uncharitable, and I think that he dismisses some of his philosophy far too quickly. It is still absolutely worth a read. It is academically rigorous while remaining eminently readable, and it gives you a fantastic idea of what you might want to read next. Paul Grice's Studies in the Way of Words. To move from the existential to the everyday, there are few things it is more helpful to understand than language. It is perhaps humanity's most versatile tool. We all use it every single day to communicate with one another. If we all stopped being able to understand language tomorrow, then our societies would collapse overnight. So for all that, it's surprising just how little popular interest there is in the study of language. I'm not talking about etymology or the evolution of words here, as interesting as that might be. I'm talking about how language functions in practice between its users. It's about getting inside the machinery of conversation itself. And this is where the work of Paul Grice is an excellent place to start. He was a highly respected name in academic philosophy and was a huge influence in cognitive linguistics, but I'd so rarely hear him talked about outside of those spheres. I've only had the opportunity to mention him once before on this channel, and I am a huge fan. So, let me give you a quick rundown of what he covers in this book, and I'm going to focus pretty much entirely on the first half, just because that's the bit that I find most interesting. Grice charts out a whole bunch of ideas which are revolutionary the first time you hear them, but in hindsight seem so obvious that it's a miracle that you didn't spot them before. The most simple distinction is just that of utterance meaning versus speaker meaning. The utterance meaning is the literal contents of a sentence, whereas the speaker meaning is what the speaker intends to say with that sentence. We're all aware of this at some level. If it is the height of summer and all the windows in the room are shut, someone saying "it's hot in here" may very well be trying to express "open a window." I don't know about elsewhere, but this divergence can become pretty extreme in the UK, where "not bad" can mean "I want to kiss your big, beautiful brain," and "that's bold" can mean "what on earth are you talking about, you complete and utter lunatic." But what is this divergence between utterance meaning and speaker meaning, and how do we make sense of it? Well, Grice thinks the answer is partly found in implicature. That is, what is implied by a sentence, but not outright stated. Much implicature is highly contextually dependent. And at first, it might seem like it would evade any systematic treatment. But Grice gives it a very good go. He first establishes a principle called the cooperative principle, which in turn is outlined in four maxims. The first is the maxim of quantity: be as informative as is required for the purposes of the conversation, but not excessively more so. Second is the maxim of quality: be honest and do not say anything you don't have good reason to think is true. Third is the maxim of relation, which is just be relevant to the conversation. And fourth is the maxim of manner, which is to be clear in your speech, avoid obscurity, ambiguity, and excessive length, and do so as much as is appropriate in that context. Grice thinks that something is implied when a speaker violates one of these maxims, but does it in such an obvious way that you can't help but infer some intent behind it. A weirdly good example of this was in the interviews leading up to the Game of Thrones season 8 finale, which was largely seen as a disappointment. I probably can't play the clip for copyright reasons, but an interviewer asked Emilia Clarke, who was the actress who played Daenerys Targaryen, if she was happy with how the show ended. In response, Emilia Clarke gave a deliberate nervous laugh and pointedly did not say yes. We all kind of know that this implies that she was not happy, but why? Well, here she has openly violated the maxim of quantity. She is being uninformative in such an obvious way that she must have intended to do so. Coupled with the context that a lead actor cannot badmouth the show they are in while it is going on, we draw the natural conclusion that what she wants to say, she cannot say explicitly. We then work backwards to figure out that she is not happy with the show. This all happens almost instantly in our minds. And yet, it's only when we sit back that we realize what exactly is happening and how this works. I think this is modern philosophy at its absolute best. Grice takes an ordinary event that we all experience multiple times per day and through careful examination discovers how it works. His theories have been hugely influential in cognitive linguistics and have most notably contributed to relevance theory, which, incidentally, I wrote my undergrad dissertation on. I genuinely think that reading Grice has made me a better speaker and a better listener, and I can't think of many other philosophers who have so profoundly affected my everyday existence. So, yes, I cannot recommend this highly enough. It is so well known within academia and so tragically underappreciated outside of it. Byung-Chul Han's The Transparency Society. Byung-Chul Han hit the bestsellers list with his The Burnout Society, which examined the phenomenon of burnout as a transformation in our value system. He argued that we have begun to view ourselves primarily as productive machines, and as a result, we have become our own overseers in the world of work. Even when we are employees, we view ourselves as entrepreneurs building the one-man business of me and conclude that the work can never stop. But in the Transparency Society, he extends this analysis to the more straightforwardly social realm in quite a worryingly relevant fashion. Since the 1980s, there's been an increasing interest in personal brand. That is, thinking of yourself and your outward presentation as analogous to a company, which has a particular polished image to maintain. Han calls this sort of attitude, where you value something simply for how others perceive it, exhibition value, and argues that it is an absolute disaster when it's the dominant way that we value ourselves. For Han, to value people based on exhibition value is to cut ourselves off from any real connection with one another. It encourages us to see other people and ourselves as simply means to garner more attention, with nothing deeper or more profound lurking below the surface. We become walking billboards for our own lives. The metric by which we judge our value comes from the amount of eyes that are on us. And this is only heightened in the rather terrifying world of social media. Of course, it might be appropriate in some cases to look at something's exhibition value. Say we are genuinely trying to sell something, then it does make sense to heavily consider what other people think of that thing. But not everything is best treated as a commodity like this, and Han certainly does not think we should treat ourselves or others in this way. Another key thread in this book is that we are now always being watched. Han argues that we are enmeshed in surveillance beyond any totalitarian's wildest dreams. Not only do we record ourselves and one another, but we also post these recordings for public consumption. It is easier than ever to take a tiny piece of information about someone and use that to find out almost everything else about them using only publicly accessible data. All of this is submitted to freely, and any dissenters are hit with that old adage, if you've got nothing to hide, then you've got nothing to fear. Han thinks that it will eventually be seen as strange not to plaster your private life online, and that it may lead to suspicions that you are, behind the scenes, up to no good. One of his major worries is that this will make a build-up of trust impossible, since trust relies on not knowing what one another are up to. For Han, trust is the confidence that someone will not hurt you even when they are not being watched, and so you cannot directly know what they're doing. But as we increasingly partake in this mutual monitoring scheme, trust becomes ever harder to establish. But without trust, we also struggle to allow privacy. Han envisions the endpoint of all of this as a vicious sort of transparency, where our private realms become smaller and smaller as we are watched not just by the state, but by one another. And eventually, we will submit to the dominant value system and willingly display each aspect of our private lives to total strangers, not realizing that we now have absolutely nothing special to share with those closest to us. In our pursuit of transparency and exhibition and attention, we've turned ourselves into shop mannequins. We no longer have friends, but spectators, and we all serve as spectators to others. Public life is then no longer the free association of individuals communicating with one another as other people, but a world of isolated atoms, each vying for a moment in the public spotlight. You may quite fairly accuse me of hypocrisy here, but I still think that it's something we ought to be concerned about. And Hahn's book examines all of this and so much more in a pretty compelling critique of the modern ethic of transparency. A fair warning, though, Hahn can be pretty dense at points, so if you're struggling to get through it, or you find that you read him at a very slow pace, don't be alarmed. That is absolutely par for the course. Bertrand Russell's In Praise of Idleness and Other Essays. This is probably a more well-known one than many of the others on this list, but I still think not nearly enough people have heard of it or read it for how immensely cool it is. Bertrand Russell was, for his entire life, a hardcore analytic thinker. He wrote extensively on logic, the foundations of mathematics, and other highly formalized approaches to philosophical problems. This is where I first encountered him, and I am proud to have the dubious honor of slogging through at least half of Principia Mathematica in what was probably the most bewildering reading experience of my life, and on top of it all, it was totally pointless. However, in his later years, he turned his attention to both personal and social issues. The first two essays of this volume are perhaps the most interesting, and they concern idleness and knowledge, respectively. The second one, A Defense of Learning That Seems Useless, is a personal favourite of mine, but the first one is fantastic as well. Each of them presents a real challenge to the narrative many of us have received as a child, that the most important thing in our lives is what we do and what we produce, and that anything unproductive, idle, or useless must be thrown into the fire as childish or pointless. Funnily enough, I am currently working on a video about philosophical solutions to burnout, so I've reread these essays very recently, and I still think that they perfectly balance precision and readability. You may not agree with them, but you're never unclear on what they mean, and they never strike the reader as irrelevant or meandering. Russell talks about the beauty of speech, the way that learning can enhance your everyday experience, and how we've devalued leisure to an almost pathological degree. Each of these topics has been covered at length by other thinkers, especially continental philosophers, and arguably to a much greater depth than Russell. Philip Mainlander, for instance, has one of the greatest accounts of beauty that I have ever read, and Sartre has a more sophisticated account of work as identity. However, these texts are also much more difficult to engage with and are much more disconnected from everyday existence and everyday concerns than Russell's essays are here. Russell points out that idleness, or leisure, is often where we discover what we value, where we can shamelessly indulge our curiosity and grow as people in a considered direction. Russell gives a counterpoint to the expression, "the devil makes work for idle hands," by pointing out that free time also gives people room to make great discoveries, strengthen the bonds in their communities, and simply enjoy life. He wants us to be educated in how to treasure and appreciate our experiences, rather than simply in utilitarian crafts. Above all, he wants us to get our priorities straight. All of this abundance that the Industrial Revolution and the modern age since this was written have brought ought to be used to free up our time, rather than find new ways to use it productively or squeeze more effort out of us. And these are just the first two essays. Russell writes on a huge variety of topics in this volume. He talks about the politics of his time, the attitude he thinks we ought to have towards money, what defines a civilization, and a whole lot more. Each of these essays reads as both witty and confident. These are not inherently virtues in a work of philosophy, but they do make it rather entertaining. The wide range of topics also means you're likely to find many things in here with which you agree, and a whole lot with which you vehemently disagree. That trademark Russellian confidence makes every agreement enthusiastic and every disagreement ardent. If you'll allow me to go on a bit of a tangent, I think this is actually one of the real strengths of reading essay collections more generally. Since they tend to talk about a lot of different things, it's increasingly unlikely that you will agree with all of it, and this makes for some excellent philosophical exercise. Standing up to an intellectual titan like Russell and articulating where you think that he has gone wrong in his thinking is a real treat. Having said that, it's probably lucky that he can't reply, or else he would probably pummel us into dust with a counterargument. So, that's my list. there are so many others that should really be on here, like Mainlander's A Philosophy of Redemption, or Curran's A Short History of Decay, or Hasok Chang's Realism for Realistic People, which I only didn't include because I'm only about a third of the way through it. But we will genuinely be here all day if I carry on. Though, do let me know if you like this video and I might make it a series. And if you want to understand some of the most famous quotes from the history of philosophy and how they are often misused, then click here to watch my video on just that. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.